I read those verses, well, I'll read them again actually. Many people out of fear flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from suffering, from all suffering. And then the next three verses go like this. He who goes for refuge to the enlightened one, to the truth, and to the spiritual community, and who sees with perfect wisdom the four Aryan truths, namely suffering, the origin of suffering, the passing beyond suffering, and the Aryan Eightfold Way leading to the pacification of suffering, for him, this is a safe refuge. For him, this is the best refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So this is the Dhammapada, the section on the enlightened one. So every morning before our meditation, we chant the Tiratanavandana, the salutation to the three jewels. And the first part of each vandana is going through the qualities of each of the three jewels. There's the Buddha Vandana, Dharma Vandana, Sangha Vandana. And the Tiratanavandana is really describing a reflection, a meditation, to generate that clear and lucid Shraddha, that clear and lucid faith that I talked about yesterday. When we reflect on those qualities in the Tiratanavandana and chant those qualities, it's to lift the mind up and to generate great pleasure and calm and confidence derived from the jewels of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But after rehearsing the qualities of the three jewels, there's a big change, there's a shift, because we say, for example, Buddhang Jivita Pariyantang Saranang Gacchami, for the whole of my life, to the Buddha for refuge I go. And the same with the Dharma and the Sangha. So you contemplate them as the jewels and then you go for refuge to them. So it's not simply that the three jewels are values that you admire and respect and revere and love, important though those responses are. But the refuges, the jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, are the embodiments of what is ultimately reliable, ultimately meaningful, that which you regard as giving you deepest satisfaction. Put in sort of traditional, sort of Hindu, Indian terms, I remember, this is something that Sangharakshita talked about in a lecture in India way back in the late 1970s. He said, when you go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, you move from being a devotee to being a disciple. And Bhante used to say, he's heard Indian yogis say, I have 10,000 devotees, 10,000 bhaktas, and I have two disciples, two shishyas. So there's 10,000 who admire, revere, who like the guru, because he makes life more comfortable for them, perhaps. But there are only two who are actually attempting to live as he lives, to follow the path. Ordination into the Western Buddhist order arises when order members are convinced that you are a disciple, that you're committed to the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha, that they are your refuge. In the West, I think we the bhaktas, the devotees in the West, are kind of cool bhaktas, cool devotees. They like Buddhism. Buddhism's pleasant. It makes worldly life a bit better. The Buddha, well, he's a nice guy, nice saintly guy, kind, all that, clear. And his teaching, it's nice, it kind of gives you sort of nice techniques to kind of help you kind of improve yourself and kind of get into a better groove, relax and stuff. And the Sangha, they're nice, friendly people, they're really nice people, the Sangha. Well, that's your cool bhakta. That's your cool bhakta. And that's nowhere near what going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha really means. I'm sure you're getting that impression. I mean, I gather that, some people a bit stirred by what we're talking about. Well, that's a good thing. It means that one's sort of moving from being a cool bhakta, perhaps, to being more of a hot disciple. That's so I want to look at the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as refuges. As refuges. And this is a very rich topic indeed. And I want to explore just a very little bit their qualities, levels, dimensions. We can only really touch on a few things. So first of all, let's look at the Buddha as refuge. So the Buddha is the awakened one, the enlightened one. To go for refuge to the Buddha means that you are convinced that Shakyamuni the Buddha, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, Gotama the Buddha, is indeed the fully enlightened Buddha, the fully enlightened one. When we say that that little Pali word, ittipiso, that's very significant. Ittipiso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho. Ittipiso means such indeed is he. He is this. He is, actually, it really is the case that he is Bhagava. He is the one richly endowed with all the great, fully developed human qualities. Human qualities taken to their highest possible pitch of intensity, love, compassion, fearlessness, and so on. He really is the Bhagava. He really is the Arahant, meaning that he's one who's liberated from all the asavas, all the poisonous floods of negativity and ignorance. He's liberated, completely liberated from them. And he really is Samyak Sambuddha, the complete, fully and perfectly enlightened one of wisdom and compassion. He sees things as they really are in their breadth and their depth. So when we go for refuge to the Buddha, we're not going for refuge to the Buddha as a good bloke. You know, a sort of super good bloke. He's not an ordinary man. He's not even regarded as a sort of, you know, a saint like saints in other traditions. He stands way above any other attainment attained by anybody else. He embodies the ideal of enlightenment that we can actually attain. This is also very important. So we regard him as the fully enlightened one, but we can attain that ideal. Going for refuge to the Buddha means that we can attain that ideal. It might be very far distant. It might be sublime and profound and beyond all our comprehension. That's kind of irrelevant. The distance, the awesomeness of the attainment, that's sort of irrelevant. What's important is that you resonate, you know, with that great ideal. You have a sense of it deep within you, and you're being pulled, impelled towards that ideal. There's a movement in you going towards it, and it's the connection between you and that sublime ideal. That's the really important thing. You know, there's in later Buddhism, in the Avatamsaka traditions, they have some very interesting things to say about Shraddha, to say about faith. Very, very interesting things that are said about that in sort of commentarial material. They kind of push Shraddha as far as they can go. In a way, they kind of work out this implication that it's of potentiality. They say the whole of the path and enlightenment itself is contained in Shraddha. That could be misunderstood. We know what that could lead to. That could lead to all sorts of, you know, inflation. But the brilliance of the point is, look, it's all there in that response. If you're responding to the Buddha, if it's making you move in the direction of enlightenment, doesn't matter how far you are from it, that's the main thing, the response and the movement. It's all in there. You've just got to live it out in its fullness. So you have Shraddha, the awakened seed of enlightenment, pushing through. And it's out of that that you say, Buddham saranam gacchami, to the Buddha for refuge, I go. And while we're on the topic, you know, when you come across this phrase, as you get a lot, and in some translations of Buddhist texts, this language of taking refuge. I mean, that is not a translation of gacchami. You know, when you get texts where it says, I have taken refuge, or I have been given refuge. The Pali idiom, the Sanskrit idiom, is always going, moving, committing. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. It's a very strong word. Gacchāmi. I go. It's an imperative. So the Buddha as refuge isn't a god, isn't some saintly guy. I remember Sangharakshita at one time saying, you know, the Buddha is a completely new category. He's not God, he's not man. He's enlightened man. And that's a category all of its own, which is attainable by us. He embodies our highest and deepest ideal that we're impelled to attain. And because of this, he is the teacher. He is Satta Deva Manusa, the teacher of gods and men. So the term Satta, S-A-T-T-H-A, with two little dots under both the T's, one dot under each T, so it's pronounced something like Satta. I can't do it properly, it's one of those palatals. But he's the Satta, the teacher. And this term Satta is only used for the Buddha in Buddhist tradition. It's not used by anybody else. It's a special term for the Buddha. He is the teacher, because it's he in this time and in this world system who has made known the way to enlightenment. And we are in his sasana, his dispensation of the Dharma. We're still running on the teacher Shakyamuni's Dharma. That hasn't run out. It's still alive and active. And he's the teacher of gods and men. His teaching is regarded traditionally as transcending all other teachings. So going for refuge to the Buddha means that he is your teacher and you follow his teaching. Other teachers and teachings are regarded as unreliable. They don't reveal the truth in its fullness. And it's said in Indian Buddhist manuals, in Indian Buddhist sutras, in fact, that it's a sign of going for refuge to the Buddha that you no longer go for refuge, you no longer worship and follow the teachings of the Hindu gods and Hindu teachers. They are not enlightened and they do not show the way to it. You go for refuge to the Buddha. He is your teacher and you follow his teaching. Now, when we talk like this, people can start to get very uneasy. They start to immediately think, well, is this a sort of Buddhist fundamentalism, and does this mean that there's going to be intolerance and hatred of other traditions and so on? But for traditional Buddhism, it doesn't imply any of that, because of course central to the Buddha's enlightenment is love, compassion and kshanti, and kshanti of course can be translated as tolerance. Clarity regarding the nature of the Buddha and the meaning of commitment to the Buddha means also a commitment to loving kindness. And it is also said, he who goes for refuge to the Buddha renounces violence and harming. That's the first direct manifestation of going for refuge to the Buddha, is the first precept, living by the first precept. So there's no sort of question here of any kind of hatred of other traditions. But that doesn't mean that Buddhists aren't clear about the nature of the teacher that they follow and the teaching that he taught. It is distinct, and as far as Buddhism is concerned, superior, you know, to other traditions. And that's why it's a real refuge. No doubt this will be debated in the discussion groups tomorrow. So when we go for refuge to the Buddha must be our focus, must be our centre. And of course it is why the Buddha is at the centre of our refuge tree. He is at the centre of our mandala. And the refuge tree is actually a mandala. And the Buddha needs to be at the centre of our consciousness if we're serious about going for refuge to the Buddha, so that all our energies are directed on enlightenment. Placing the Buddha at the centre of our mandala, that's a sort of image that Sangharakshita uses, means that he has become, as it were, our sovereign, our king. The mandala isn't just a sort of flat diagram. Traditional mandalas are the central figure is in a mandala palace, like a sort of king and a sovereign, which creates order and patterning, a natural order. So we place the Buddha at the centre of our consciousness. So how do we do that? How can we bring the Buddha into the centre of our consciousness? Well, first of all, becoming very, very familiar with the life of the Buddha as recounted in the Pali Canon, especially the Pali Canon. So important to read and reread and study this sort of material. And Sangharakshita, I think, is a wonderful guide to that in some of his lectures when and expounding certain incidents in the life of the Buddha. Sometimes when he used to do that and had the good fortune of being at some of his talks, you really felt what it might be like to be around the Buddha, the way he evoked a particular story. Listen to the case of dysentery. Actually listen to the lecture. The sort of tenderness with which he tells the story of the Buddha and the way the Buddha is with the monks. You really got to get a feeling of what it might have been like to have been around an enlightened being. It's really wonderful. Some of his study seminars have that flavour. I did say in a talk recently, referring to something Subhuti said years ago, that in many ways Sangharakshita's main teacher is the Buddha. Yes, of course he had, all these other teachers, but when you hear him talking about the Buddha and his emphasis on the teachings of the historical Buddha, and if you look at some of his early poems when he was a young man, his early poems of devotion to the Buddha, you really get the impression of somebody who, for whom the Buddha is their teacher, is their refuge. I think Sadaloka's book his book Encounters with Enlightenment, I think it's called. The retelling of some of those, really beautiful stories of the Buddha. That's a very good way into, getting a feeling for the historical Buddha. Recollection of the Buddha is a really venerable Buddhist practice. It's in fact recommended as one of the main recollections, just bringing the Buddha to mind. And in some of the very early schools, not Theravadin schools, some of the northern early schools, their version of the Satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness, the last is not mindfulness of Dhammas, it's mindfulness of the Buddha. It's bringing the Buddha to mind, recollecting the Buddha. And it's a very, very venerable practice, this recollection of the Buddha. There's a very beautiful incident recounted in the commentary on the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So after the Buddha has entered Parinibbana, the cremation has happened and all the rest of it, Ananda goes back to Shravasti. He goes back to the place where the Buddha spent all those rainy seasons. And Ananda was with him during that time. And Ananda goes to the Gandakuti, as it's called, the perfumed chamber, which was the name of the Buddha's kuti, where he used to stay. And Ananda swept the floor, went to get water and put water in a jug, laid out a mat and sat as if the Buddha was present. As if his teacher, the Buddha, was present. Some commentators in the tradition say, this is just Ananda's attachment to the Buddha. I think not. I will disagree with the venerables there. I think that this is Ananda's practice of recollecting the Buddha. Well, what other way is he going to bring the presence of enlightenment? What's the most natural way to bring the presence of enlightenment into his consciousness? He's going to recollect the Buddha. The Buddha is going to be imagined there with him. And apparently it was a tradition in the monastic order in India, even again after the Buddha's Parinibbana, during the Buddha's lifetime and after, that when the monks would gather, they'd always place out a seat for the Buddha in case he turned up. So they're sitting as if the Buddha could come. What a wonderful, practice. So that there's this space that they're giving to the enlightened one. So they're remembering their refuge, remembering their teacher, remembering their ideal. So it's very important, I think, in whatever way, to recollect the Buddha, to bring the Buddha into your consciousness. You know, enlightenment can so easily, all these terms, nirvana, shunyata, blah, 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 it all gets so sort of abstract, you know, pure consciousness beyond subject and object. I mean, who cares? You know, so much better that it's embodied. Embodied, you have a sense of the embodied presence, you know, of enlightenment. That makes it much more real, much more tangible. You know, we're persons, after all. We are embodied. So, of course, we're going to think about enlightenment as a person. You know, you get some sort of, you know, Protestants, don't you? You know, when people came across Buddhism, you know, well, they didn't have a Buddha image in the early days. They just had a symbol. And then, you know, there's this terrible sort of falling away from the pure Protestant, you know, Buddhism is a sort of Protestantism, and it's fallen away from that, and then they make images, etc. Well, it's the most natural thing in the world to make images, you know, and to make enlightenment a person, because we're persons. What else are we going to do? You know, and the Pali texts really are wonderful because they are so unequivocal in terms of how an enlightened being behaves. You read later texts, you know, Zen stuff, Tantra, all that gear. I mean, it's all very weird, and it all, you know, people can really misunderstand. When you read the life of the Buddha, it's unequivocal the way an enlightened being behaves. Not always that pleasant, I have to say. You know, I remember being very struck when my dad told me that the local bishop came to his church, which was called St. Francis. And the bishop, when he gave his sermon, said, you know, if St. Francis came here, you wouldn't like him. You'd be appalled by him, you know. And my dad was really taken with this idea. He thought it sounded fantastic, you know, this vagabond, you know, St. Francis coming in. Actually, you know, he wouldn't be that acceptable. Well, it's probably the same with the Buddha. You know, if the Buddha came in here and gave a talk on going for refuge, I mean, we all think, oh, wow, if we were with the Buddha, we'd just sort of go up to enlightenment. He'd probably be saying things that are so kind of hardcore and on the line, we'd be out the door. You know, we wouldn't be sticking around. It would be far too demanding. Maybe not. What do I know? Anyway, there's something wonderfully, you know, when you read the Pali text, you know, you get a real feel for enlightenment. That's the point. And the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is one of my favourites for this. It's a very complex sutta. It's very layered, actually, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. But the bits I love more than anything is how a Buddha responds to old age and death and sickness. It's just incredible when you read the sutta. And if you can read it closely, carefully, and imagine yourself into it, you know, the complete, you know, is not defined, for example, by pain and illness. You know, there's that passage where he goes into rainy season retreat. He's stricken with the most appalling pains. He's got some terrible illness. We're not quite sure what it is. We know that he suffered from very, very bad back pain. We know in his last days he had terrible dysentery. He's 80 years old. He's lived this life of service, you know, to his community, to his world, to others. Anyway, he's in retreat. He's in terrible pain, even unto death. And he reflects, no, I'm not giving in to this because I need to address the community. He bears it mindfully, clearly aware. He's not sort of defined in any way by the pain. He pushes it down. He takes hold of life, as the text says. And a bit later, Ananda, who can see what's going on with this man, is very distressed and talks to him about what's going on. And and the Buddha says, yes, I mean, I am in a bad way. But I get free of it. I get respite from it because I can dwell in the signless samadhi. I can dwell in the signless samadhi. So he's bigger than his pain. He's bigger than his pain. There's an amazing passage in the Dhammapada where it's talking about the Arahant. And there's a rather interesting two verses which are talking about nourishment and food. And what they mean by nourishment in the Pali text isn't just actual physical food. They also mean experience, kind of all sense experience. And it's basically saying that an arahant isn't nourished just by sense experience. He's drawing on the signless, the wishless, the deathless. He's drawing on that. And of course, the Buddha is also drawing on love and tenderness and kindness and compassion for those around him. You know, he's defined by that. He's not just going to, you know, he could die like that. He's not attached to his body in any way, but he stays out of compassion, out of love. And it's not sort of grandmotherly compassion, you know, that you know, just going there, dear, you know, to everybody. Sometimes he's quite rousing and sort of challenging. The relationship with Ananda is very interesting. They're very, very tender, but urging and rousing Ananda to make more spiritual effort. And it isn't just a sort of general, you know, I love you all kind of love. It's particular. It's to individuals within the Sangha, as I said, to Ananda and to Subhadra at the end, to Subhadra. You know, this man who comes at the end, wants a teaching, just as the Buddha's about to go out into Parinirvana. And Ananda says, well, he's, you know, leave him. He's leaving. And the Buddha says, no, come, he'll understand. And he teaches the Dharma on that stone couch right at the end. So I just find this incredible. You get a sense of, if you want to have any sense of how enlightenment is a refuge in relation to old age, disease and death, have a good look at the Parinibbana Sutta. You know, and there's this constant refrain, he bears it mindfully and clearly aware. He bears it mindfully and clearly aware, and also with love and kindness and consideration. And there are other things as well, you know, real human touches, his love of nature. You know, he says how much he loves dwelling in these old shrines, these old sort of, well, they're kind of older groves of trees, nature spirits, probably very quiet places. He loves to dwell in them, and he loves silence. And then you get the deep mystery of Nirvana itself, the Parinirvana itself. You know, you have to read that and imagine him moving through dhyanas and kind of up and down all the states of consciousness and then entering sort of inconceivable liberation. If a refuge is to be a true refuge, it needs to transcend death, not by being a superman, of course, not by attaining some sort of eternal heaven, but through giving us an example, a way of teaching how to actually face death, how to look it in the eye. That's how you actually transcend it. You transcend all this through looking into it. As Sangharakshita says, you know, you attain the unconditioned through contemplating the conditioned. And to take the Buddha as refuge and teacher, So to go for refuge to the Buddha and to take him as our teacher, we have to be working it out. We have to be following the Buddha's example, following his example, following his teaching, doing it ourselves. The Buddha is also the embodiment of what's called the Artha in Pali text, Artha in Sanskrit, which means the goal. This is used an awful lot in the Pali text. You know, often enlightenment, nirvana, is just called the Artha, the goal, or the good, or even true meaning. So going for refuge to the Buddha means keeping that goal in mind, always. And the goal, you know, sometimes you say to people, you know, people say, well, I don't really have much of a feeling for enlightenment. And when you inquire into it, of course, it's just one notion of enlightenment that they've kind of heard about. And they think that's the only way in which it's sort of evoked. But go and look up Sangharakshita's chapter called The Goal in the Three Jewels. It's fantastic. Bit of classic Sangharakshita, compact, condensed writing. Because he points out all the ways, not all the ways, but many of the ways in which enlightenment, the goal, is spoken of, you know, negatively. In other words, what is expelled in enlightenment? You know, all negative emotion, all ignorance, all suffering, that goes. positively. The cognitive aspect of that, you know, seeing things as they are. The affective aspect of that, bliss, happiness, compassion, love. The volitional aspect of nirvana, vimukti, vimoksha, freedom, liberation, and unbounded energy and creativity. And then the goal is, you know, metaphors and similes used. The island amidst the floods of destruction, the island that can't be knocked over, the ancient city. There's a lovely one in the Pali text. You know, there's this ancient city in the jungle that has been rediscovered, the harbour of refuge, and so on. There's so much, so many stories and myths and, yes, symbols of enlightenment. It brings us back. He talks about enlightenment as a person. There's a very interesting discussion about enlightenment as a person. You know, so you have the Buddha and different Buddhas, the five Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and so on. So enlightenment being embodied in the most beautiful of forms. Beauty, meaning, truth, purity, reality, all embodied in the most beautiful of forms that we can actually have a direct connection with. And this is why at ordination, you're initiated into a mantra and you're given a sadhana, a way of meditating on that particular form, that particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. And it's recommended very strongly that you do such a practice every day in some way or another. And the point is that that means every day you're contemplating the goal. Every day you're contemplating enlightenment. Directly, you're contemplating enlightenment. That's the point of it, as is in the form of a sort of archetype, even a sort of myth. And I don't mean a sort of Jungian archetype here, something far transcending that. These images are sometimes described as explosions of shunyata, explosions of reality, reality taking form. You could even describe them as sort of doorways that you go through to the unbounded shunyata, the unbounded reality. And you're also sort of unfolding something in yourself when you meditate on a figure like this. The qualities of enlightenment begin to start unfolding in you, but in a very mysterious sort of way, a way it's very hard to describe. Sangharakshita was once asked, well, what are the benefits of meditating on green Tara? Because green Tara is his yidam, the practice he was, the sadhana he was first initiated into, and which he's done a lot of meditation on. And his answer was very interesting. He said, meditating on green Tara, you discover or you attain or whatever, I can't remember the exact way he put it, the spiritual equivalent of greenness. And he said no more. So it's very important to have this in one's life. The Buddha or Bodhisattva is, in the old Indian tantric tradition, it's called the Ishta Devata, the desired deity. It's the image of our deepest desires, our deepest aspirations. You know, we image our desires. The stronger our desires, the more we image them. So if we're to leave samsara, if we're to leave ignorance, we need to invoke a force stronger than ignorance, stronger than that trishna, that craving I talked about, stronger than upadana, clinging, stronger than hate. We're going to have to develop a very strong desire. So the image of the Buddha or the Bodhisattva on which we meditate, it's there to evoke that deep desire, that dharma chanda, as it's called, that desire for truth and reality. So these are the different ways in which we can recollect the Buddha in order to intensify our going for refuge to the Buddha. But, very important, this doesn't mean bringing the Buddha to the mind, bringing the Buddha into consciousness. You know, sometimes, you know, when you talk like this, I mean, I bet this is said tomorrow in the study group when we get to this point. Yeah, but let's not get carried away. Let's not get our head up in the clouds. Well, you know, my head isn't up in the clouds. That isn't what we're talking about. You need to connect your, you know, that profound connection with the Buddha with your daily life, with your daily activities, your ultimate goal, your refuge, the Buddha refuge, even your sort of vision of the Buddha, even your best moments, if you like, need to be connected with your day-to-day activities, need to be brought in relation to what's going on moment by moment. And of course, the direct way of doing this, the most obvious way to do that, is through the precepts. The direct manifestation of contemplation of Buddhahood is practicing the precepts, because the precepts are the way a Buddha naturally behaves. The precepts are a way of aligning ourselves with reality. So actually following each of the precepts, we're actually aligning ourselves much more fully with the Buddha refuge. You know, sometimes people, we met loads of people who have had all sorts of visions or things they regard as insights and all the rest of it, you know, breakthroughs, and then you actually look at them getting drunk, hurting people, and you think, well, not much insight there. I'm saying stupid things. Not much vision there. Pow. If you were from Scotland. Anyway. So going for refuge to the Buddha, the direct manifestation of that is the practice of the precepts. Even friendship. There's an incredible thing in Sangharakshita's case of dysentery lecture, which I love talking about, and I've said it just about every talk I've done here. He asks, why does the Buddha have a companion? Why does the Buddha have Ananda? You know, is it just, you know, he said the traditional explanation is, well, every single Buddha that there's ever been has always had two chief disciples. They've always had a sort of Ananda type figure. You know, they've always had, you know, they're all the same. And Sangharakshita said, well, it's not really a very satisfactory explanation, you know, that the Buddha has Ananda to sort of keep up appearances. He's certainly not convinced by it, you know, Buddha appearances. So he was saying, well, no, because the Buddha is with Ananda because communication is intrinsic to enlightenment. At the heart of enlightenment, there is communication. So at the heart of enlightenment, there is friendship. Incredible thing to say. And he said, this is related to that very mysterious concept that you find in Mahayana Buddhism of the Sambhogakaya, which literally means the body or the dimension of the Buddha, which is in a state of mutual delight or mutual enjoyment. But he didn't say anything about what he meant by that. And, well, I won't either let you meditate on that. But certainly, in going for refuge to the Buddha, a sign of going for refuge to the Buddha is a greater sense of connection and interconnection with others. And when we start talking about the precepts, we're starting to move into the Dharma refuge. So let's start talking about the Dharma refuge. So first of all, the Dharma means truth or reality. The way things are as revealed by the Buddha. The way things are as revealed by the Buddha. So one of the points being made here that this isn't just one possible way of looking at things. As far as the Buddha and Buddhism is concerned, the Dharma is reality. The Dharma is the truth. It's the way things are. It's the way it is. Now, in the end, of course, this is deeply mysterious. And the Dharma is interesting because it's very hard to grasp, actually. You know, it's very clear the way it's sort of expounded. But there's always this point that in the end, the Dharma as revealed by the Buddha is actually beyond all words, all conceptions, all notions of time, space, self, other, and all the structures and polarities of conditioned existence. I'll just read you just a little bit, not from a Pali text. This is from a Nyingma text that Sangharakshita translated. It's from a sadhana that he was given, associated with Vajrasattva. I'll just read you a little bit of it. It's trying to really evoke the profoundest mystery of the Dharma. Emao, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones, within the birthless all things take their birth, yet in what's born there is no birth. Emao, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones, within the ceaseless all things cease to be, yet in that ceasing nothing ceases. And it goes on in that way for a few verses, but let's not get too involved in that now. So this kind of level of the Dharma, what's being evoked there, is synonymous with Buddhahood, actually. And in the Mahayana, this is called the Dharmakaya. That dimension of the Buddha, that dimension of enlightenment that is the way things are. That vast, unbounded dimension of the Buddha that's coterminous with reality, and it's regarded as the ultimate refuge. So this does make the Buddha Dharma very different from other traditions because of this. There's great emphasis in Buddhism on clarity, on right view. It's very incredibly important. You know, it's the first stage of the Eightfold Path, right view. But all views in the end kind of dissolve into silence, into peace, into those three shantis that we chant at the end of the puja. The Dharma is too vast, too profound, too rich to be contained in any definition. But, as the awakening of faith has it, we use words to go beyond words to attain the pure wordless essence. We use words to go beyond words to attain the pure wordless essence. So this kind of, I love this particular little saying, because it's making it clear that words, views, concepts, ideas are extraordinarily important. You can't just jump straight into the wordless, empty reality. It is said in the Pali text that the Tathagata has no views. And the way Sangharakshita explains this is that the Buddha will use views to teach his Dharma, but he has a critical awareness that no concept can adequately encompass the reality that he's attained. Or another way of putting it, in you know, more sort of down to earth way, Sangharakshita once said, when all the answers are in your being, there's no need to keep them in your head. But the Buddha did indeed use words and ideas to communicate that wordless vision. And it's very important to study those words, to reflect on those words, and to live those words, to make them a living experience. So going for refuge to the Dharma means getting a grasp of the Buddha's basic teaching, the original teaching. So here we go again. It means really getting hold of and engaging with Pratichasamutpada, cyclic aspect, the progressive aspect. It means really getting hold of and a feeling for Nirvana, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Lakshanas, the Four Viparyasas, etc., etc. And so just so incredibly important to study this stuff and to reflect on it. These teachings aren't arbitrary. You know, all this stuff about going beyond words. You hear some people saying, well, you can use any words. Call it God, call it Nirvana, call it Shiv Shakti, cosmic couple, whatever you like. It's all the same, because in the end it's all beyond words. But no. The Buddha's wisdom also includes the wisdom of finding the most accurate, the most precise words to reflect his enlightenment, to reflect the Dharma that he's realised. So his teachings are like a sort of mirror reflecting his sort of word transcending attainment. You have to look into that mirror, go through that mirror. So, you know, meditate on conditioned co-production. Meditate on arising and ceasing. Meditate deeply on it, and you begin to sense the reality that it points to is vast, impossible to articulate in any one set of words. But these words are the kind of the best way into it all. And of course, to be able to do this, you also need not just you know, study and reflection, you also need to be practicing ethics and meditation and so on. So it's very important to stay with basic Buddhist doctrine. Be very careful of later developments in Buddhism. Very, very careful of shunyata, emptiness, and Tathagatagarbha, you know, especially in its sort of Buddha nature form. Be very careful with consciousness only. These teachings can only be understood if you've spent years meditating on and living by the basic doctrine, living by Pratichasamutpada, for example, living by the middle way. You know, I've seen people who are attracted to shunyata, they just become incredibly nihilistic. You know, they think, well, everything is empty, that means all values are empty. And they become really sort of depressive. That isn't Buddhism, you know, and they've got to go back to the beginning. And then you get people into consciousness only and Buddha nature. Well, they end up with eternalism. You know, I'm enlightened already. I've always been enlightened already. I always will be enlightened already. I don't need to do anything. Everything is here and now. Blah, 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 blah. You know, and of course, if you criticise that, somehow that isn't perfect. You're not perfect. You know, weird. Anyway, go back to the basic doctrine. Go back to Pratichasamutpada. You know, you get into big problems if you go astray from the basic doctrine. You lose the refuge in the end. You lose the way to liberation, which is what the Dharma refuge is. And then we have to start living the Dharma, seeing it working out in our life. What are we actually going to do? And essentially, Buddhist life, going for refuge to the Dharma, is this becoming. Mrs. Rhys Davids, this old early translator, describes the Buddhist path as something like, it's becoming a more to becoming a most. This wonderful little maxim. And you also get this wonderful word in the Pali and Sanskrit texts, which describes what Buddhist practice is like. They use this word pariparchana. Pariparchana, which literally means ripening. It's a ripening. Going for refuge to the Dharma means that you are ripening. You're becoming like a wonderful ripe fruit. Or you could also translate that as a maturing. It can also mean that you're stop being... Ripening also means that you're not... the opposite of it is kacha, which means hard, uncooked. Pariparchana is a bit like the Hindi word pukka, actually. I think it's related to that. Which literally means soft, cooked. Where am I going with this? Anyway... I don't know. But the main point is this maturing, this ripening. I just think that's a lovely image. And you hear it and you see it again in the last teaching of the Buddha. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he gave this sort of summary of his teaching wherever he went. He'd always give a comprehensive Dharma discourse, as the text has it, so which could be summed up in these words. He says, this is samadhi, in other words, concentration, absorption. Great is the fruit, great is the advantage of samadhi when it's set round with shila, or ethical behaviour, ethics, the precepts. This is prajna. Great is the fruit, great is the advantage of prajna when set round with samadhi. The mind filled with prajna is utterly liberated from the great floods of sense experience, of fixed being, and of ignorance. So I love this because it makes it clear that the Dharma is progressive. Ethics supports the growth of meditation. Meditation supports the growth of wisdom. Wisdom leads to liberation. There is this ripening, this maturing, this growing. And the more you do this, the more you sense this happening, the more the Dharma becomes a refuge for you. You realise this is reliable. This is the way things are. This works. There's a sutta in the Pali text. Unfortunately, I thought it was in the Nidanavagga, but I think it's somewhere else, where the Buddha is talking about the progressive Nidanas. And he says, you don't need to try and develop the next stage. If you just concentrate on the stage you're on, It's the Dharmata, the Dharmaness, the natural way of things for the next stage to arise. So in dependence upon dukkha arises Shraddha. Well, don't worry about the next stage. Just deepen your awareness of unsatisfactoriness. Deepen your response to the three jewels. Deepen and deepen that, and naturally you'll see that emerging into the other stages. So the Dharma grows in this way. So we know that the Dharma is also very, very rich. I mean, there's so many teachings. You know, you probably think it's all a bit much, you know, on this retreat, so much, you know, that you know, we're chucking at you. And so it's kind of hard to know what to do sometimes, isn't it? So we need a kind of criteria for assessing our Dharma practice. And I'm just going to read you something that Sangharakshita was fond of quoting years ago. It's the advice of the Buddha to Maha Prajapati, who was his aunt and stepmother, who became a nun. And she wasn't sure. She said, well, how do I make sense of all the teachings of all your disciples? You know, how, give me a way of knowing what works. So the Buddha just says that when you can know that these things lead to dispassion, not to passion, to detachment, not to attachment, to dispersal, not to amassing, to modesty, not to ambition, to content, not to discontent, to seclusion from the group, or you could say individuality, not to getting caught up with the group, to energy, not to idleness, to frugality, not to luxury, of then you can quite certainly decide, this is the Dharma, this is the training, this is the master's teaching. You could probably reframe that perhaps a bit more positively than that. But it's very important, this criteria, because it's not enough to have a sort of vague sense of personal growth. You know, it's something very specific, growth within the Dharma and going for refuge to the Dharma. There is a transformation. We're moving away from insecure, unsafe refuges to the indestructible reality of the Dharma. And the advice comes from the Buddha, Mahaprajapati's teacher and Kalyana Mitra. So this brings us to the Sangha refuge. I know this is a long talk, but not far to go. Hold on. So the first thing to say about the Sangha refuge is, first and foremost, the Sangha refuge is the Arya Sangha, the Noble Sangha, the Transcendental Sangha. It's the Sangha of all those who've entered the transcendental path. So it's the stream entrants, those who are irreversible from enlightenment, the once returners, the non-returners, the arhats, the bodhisattvas. Perhaps in the tantric context, it's the siddhas. It's that great community of those who are the real, the true disciples of the Buddha, whose going for refuge is real. That actually is the only permanently reliable sangha, because they're going for refuge, cannot turn back. They're on irreversible spiritual development. They're the truly reliable spiritual friends. You know, sometimes I say, well, you hear people say, I just feel so let down by the sangha. What, you mean the Arya sangha? Are they letting you down? Who are you talking about? Who's let you down? And actually, it's probably quite likely that the Arya Sangha will let you down, because, I mean, sometimes people felt let down by the Buddha. I mean, it's a really interesting the sutta where somebody goes to the Buddha and they're really giving the Buddha a sort of telling off. You haven't done this, you haven't done that, you haven't taught that. And the Buddha said, did I ever say that I was like that? Did I ever say that I would teach that? And he said, no, you haven't. So then, well, what are you complaining about? Oh. And then they can actually have a communication. So, you know, anyway, so the Arya Sangha as a refuge, first of all, they're an example for us of what can be done. In a sense, the Buddha is not quite an example, because he did it completely on his own. He gained enlightenment without a teacher, without spiritual friends, without a clear path. He had nothing to go on. He had to work it out all on his own. He's an example, if you like, if you're really serious about the Bodhisattva path, because what the Bodhisattva path means that you're in training. You know, we all want to be Bodhisattvas, don't we? So we're all in training so that we can get to a point, you know, through our three kalpas worth of practicing the paramitas, we can get to a point where we are reborn in a world where there's no Buddhism, no Dharma, and we gain enlightenment on our own, and then we teach it. That's in that sense, the Buddha's an example. But anyway, the Arya Sangha are an example. They relied on the Buddha, as we are relying on the Buddha. They relied on other spiritual friends. They had the Buddha Dharma, and they made the most of the training. So the Arya Sangha is an example and an inspiration. Yabhanti was recently talking about the teachers on the refuge tree, and he said it's their example that's important. And I was really taken when he talked about Hui Neng. He said, well, Hui Neng is an incredible example for us, because there he was, an illiterate wood gatherer, you know, just sort of a wood chopper, you know, just going about, you know, chopping wood. He just hears somebody chanting the Diamond Sutra, bam, you know, he gets it. His Dharma eye opens. He's awakened. Incredible. Goes to the monastery, tells the abbot, who says, go and pound rice. So he spends, 7 years, 12 years, or however many years, pounding rice, literally and metaphorically. That's the point. He's transforming himself from that initial awakening experience. So he has the vision and then the transformation. And Sangha actually was saying, well, it's a great example that anybody can wake up to the Dharma and actually transform themselves in the light of the Dharma. And I know some people have trouble with study and remembering lists and all that sort of thing. Well, don't worry about that. So long as you can sort of get the principle and then pound rice for the rest of your life, there's hope. And then there's Dada Rinpoche. Nearer to hand, nearer to us. There were some order members who went to see him years and years ago, and he was talking, you know, telling them about, they wanted to know about his life. And of course, you know, he's regarded as a Bodhisattva. And he turned to them at some point, these order members. He said, look, what does Rinpoche mean? What does Rinpoche mean? Rinpoche means greatly precious one. It means that I'm on the Bodhisattva path. That's what Rinpoche means. And he said, look, anybody can be a Bodhisattva. You can be a Bodhisattva. And he really, you know, urged them to practice like that. It's fantastic. You know, not I'm a Rinpoche, you know, I'm an incarnate Lama and you're down there. No, you can be a Rinpoche. You can be a Bodhisattva. That's what the Arya Sangha does. Sangha Ashta says stream entry is a realistic goal in this life for everybody who seriously goes for refuge. What an incredible thing to say. You can gain irreversible spiritual development in this life if you make the necessary effort. You know, and again, a sort of a bit nearer to home, I remember a personal conversation I had with him. I happened to pick up the phone in when we had the order office here, Sangha Ratchita's office. I was looking after the office, I think. And it happened to be Bhante on the line, and you know, I had to pass on some messages. And he said, well, how are you getting on? And I said, well, okay, Bhante, but, you know, Subhuti's left and, you know, we're doing all right. And I said, but I don't know, Bhante. I said, you know, progress seems so slow and really infinitesimal. And he said, well, he said, I miss Subhuti being on retreat too. And he said, but when I kept saying, oh, you know, progress, infinitesimal, he said, no, measurable, measurable. Measurable. He just kept saying, measurable, measurable. You know, and it was saying, no, look, something's happening. Something's happening. You know, fantastic. That's what the Arya Sangha does. It, you know, so to go for refuge to the Arya Sangha means that you go for refuge to the Buddha. You go for refuge to the Dharma. They are your reliance. And you have faith and confidence that it's possible to make substantial, definitive, spiritual progress in this life. The Arya Sangha embody that for us. This means, of course, that you yourself are making every effort to become a refuge for others. In other words, a source of continuous spiritual reliability to others. In the Sigalavada Sutta, there's a discussion of true friendship. You know, just on kind of on the ordinary level, what's true friendship? And it says, you know, a true friend is a refuge to his friend. And when we studied this with Sangharakshita, he took this literally. He said, well, that means if you're going to be a true friend, you need to be a stream entrant. If you really want to be a true friend to another, it means that you have to be a stream entrant. He said, stream entry is a means to friendship. We usually think of friendship and the Sangha supporting stream entry. He turns it round. Stream entry is the means to becoming to be a true friend, because you become a refuge. You become reliable. So true spiritual growth means connecting much, much more deeply with others. This is what going for refuge to the Sangha means. I mentioned it's a kind of sign of effective going for refuge. Greater connection, greater interconnection with others. I talked a bit about the Buddha and Ananda. And of course, we're not talking about any connection. You come together with others on the basis of what is deepest in you. You come together on the basis of your Shraddha, your going for refuge. And of course, this is where the Sangha, as we usually think of it, takes place. This is what's happening in the Sangha as we know it. Faith resonating with faith, going for refuge alongside going for refuge. So this means that the Sangha is not a cozy group where you receive unconditional acceptance no matter what you do. The Sangha is not the ideal family that you never had. The Sangha is not a Buddhist club where you do your Buddhist hobby. The Sangha arises when we come together with others on the basis of what is deepest within us, when we are going for refuge, and we're connecting with others in that way. And if that's not happening, the Sangha can feel very uncomfortable. You know, if we're not doing that, you know, if we're doing something else, the Sangha can become very uncomfortable, and it's very easy to turn it into something oppressive, a sort of authority structure. You know, the Buddha uses an incredibly, almost brutal image in the Udana, and where he says, the Dharma's like the great and mighty ocean. And in the same way that a dead body is just thrown up by the mighty ocean, in the same way, that somebody who's not, in our terms, really going for refuge, the Sangha will throw them up. I mean, not that the Sangha does it deliberately, it's more that you feel as though that's happening to you. Of course, sometimes people think that they're not really doing it, when actually they are, but that's another problem. I mean, you get that on going for refuge retreats sometimes. But, you know, somebody says, I don't think I'm really doing it, you know, in a discussion group, and somebody says, No, it's me that's not really doing it. You know, we used to have this on the ordination team. We call it the weak link syndrome. You know, with the ordination team, we'd be reporting in about how we were getting on, and one of us would say, well, I think I'm letting everybody down. I'm the weak link. I'm not really doing it. And then there'd be an argument about who wasn't really doing it. And, of course, we'd all fall about laughing and realise we were being a bit self-indulgent. But anyway, that's another point. Anyway, so if the Sangha happens when we're deeply in touch with going for refuge in ourselves, and we're seeing that in others. Shraddha is meeting Shraddha. Sometimes if we feel let down by the Sangha, it can be actually because we've had other expectations of what the Sangha is. We're not thinking of meeting on that basis. It's actually something else that we're looking for, which can't be given. So what's the essential quality of Sangha? The aspiring Sangha, you know, because it's the Sangha in the process of becoming the Arya Sangha. Well, there's no better essential definition than Sangharakshita's, which you'll find in the history of my going for refuge. So this is quite a long quote. So those who go for refuge to the Sangha also go for refuge to the Buddha and the Dharma. They have a common spiritual teacher or ideal, and a common teaching or or spiritual principle, and this tends to draw them together, even on the social plane. I don't mean by that physical proximity or agreement on doctrinal questions, or even the attainment of the same stages of the spiritual path. It's rather more subtle than that. The together lies in communication, which is not just an exchange of ideas, but a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common spiritual ideal and common spiritual principle. It is a common exploration in complete harmony and complete honesty of the spiritual world. In this way, spiritual progress takes place. The exploration might be between guru and disciple, vertical spiritual friendship, or between friends, horizontal spiritual friendship. Though in the course of communication, this is fantastic, such distinctions might lose their significance. In any case, in going for refuge to the Sangha, one would be going for refuge to spiritual communication from mere contact, which is in most cases meaningless and superficial. Fantastic. I mean, what an insight into the Sangha. So this is what going for refuge to the Sangha involves. We're moving away from mere contact, which is in most cases meaningless and superficial, to spiritual communication, that vital mutual responsiveness, that exploration of the spiritual world in complete harmony and complete honesty. That's what a really good discussion group, study group should be like. Our study groups should be more like this. They're not academic study groups, by the way. So this is what going for refuge to the Sangha involves day to day. Leaving behind mere contact. Leaving behind the group, as Sangharakshita has called it. Entering into communication based on what is deepest. Drawing forth what is deepest in one another. In complete honesty. Exploring that the world of the Dharma together. With those more experienced, with those less experienced, or with those on the similar level of experience. But not being self-conscious about levels of experience. You're just in this environment. You're just so in this environment of the Dharma, of one another's practice of the Dharma. You're not thinking of, you know, levels at all. You're just in this vital mutual responsiveness. There's just this real spark happening between you. There's this responsiveness to one another. Mention that word, that Pali word, anukampa, to tremble with, to shake with. You know, that's what we're getting at here. It's more like empathy and sympathy. But in the Sangha, it's of a very special kind. You know, it's Shraddha shaking with Shraddha. You know, taking us into new territory, taking us deeper into the Dharma. So, that's what draws us together. And the effects of such togetherness are extraordinary. What happens when it really gets going is that our aspiring effective Sangha is lifted to something beyond itself. You actually have a glimpse of the Arya Sangha. You have a sort of sensation of what it would be like to be in something like the Arya Sangha, where everybody is unique, utterly unique in their spiritual practice, and yet they're in perfect harmony with one another. They've just sort of transcended the distinction between sort of separateness and togetherness. And you see it reflected in the Pali text, you know, that wonderful sutta which described those three monks called Anuruddha. Just incredible the way they live together, the way they practice together. And when the Buddha asks them about the way they are together, you know, are you dwelling in harmony like milk and water blended? Yes, we are, Bhagavan. You know, we have three bodies, but only one mind, ekachitta, one heart. And then they describe the whole path arising out of that, their attainment of the transcendental path. You know, they're distinct. You know, they're all clear and distinct, but they have one heart, one mind, and their efforts are sort of magnified because of that. So they attain the transcendental path. Or you get the Buddha. sitting in the midst of 1,250 monks all night long in silence, in the Aryan silence, the silence which is said that to start at the second dhyana, because it's the silence where there's no mental chatter. It's the silence where people have just left all that behind. And they're just dwelling together in that silence. And the inspiration is just sort of pervading the whole assembly. And yes, even in our own Sangha, I have to say, I have experienced wonderful moments of being with the order, you know, especially in things like puja or something like that, or sometimes in the order metta or something like that. And you know, something else kind of opening up. I remember one particular order convention as we chanted the Avalokiteshvara mantra repeatedly, and we were worshipping a stupa, and internally I had a strong sense of the image of Avalokiteshvara, but I could open my eyes and look at every single order member who was worshipping, and this sort of sensation that there wasn't a sort of difference between whether I focused on Avalokiteshvara inside or whether I looked at my brothers and sisters in the Dharma outside. And it was a curious thing that afterwards, you know, other people having similar sorts of experiences, these very mysterious moments. And of course, a community like this, a Sangha like this, can become a source of refuge for others. We can become an example and inspiration to others. If we are in a true Sangha opens out to others and welcomes others into it. It wants others to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It wants others to connect in that way. But to experience, I think, a Sangha like this, it's not enough, I think, to be a sort of general Buddhist. You need a specific community, a particular expression of Sangha, a living order, an order, to actually be part of. It needs to become concrete. If you like, the universals of the refuges need to become particular. You need to have a particular path of Buddhist practice, a particular tradition, and a particular system of spiritual discipline. So tomorrow I'm going to look at that. No, I'm not. Not tomorrow. Because tomorrow we're doing something else. But on Wednesday night I'm going to talk about it. When I'm going to talk about levels of going for refuge. Especially looking at effective going for refuge. Oh, and provisional as well. And the great stages of the spiritual path.